Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today is the fulfillment of a long-awaited promise. The poet David Trinidad, who was born in Los Angeles, is here to read from and talk about his book, Swinging on a Star. David and I have tried to tape the show before, and now, at last, good 20 years later, yes?
Yes, more than that, actually. Yeah.
Here we are, which is just to show you, it's one of the themes of the show, Time Brings All Things, and his most recent book of his own poetry is called Swinging on a Star. Now, tell me the names of your other books, David.
Some of the titles are Monday, Dear Prudence, New and Selected Poems, Answer Song, Plasticville.
So, in other words, you've used songs,
yes,
as the titles for your book. And Swinging on a Star, I know because it's an Academy Award-winning song from Bing Crosby's movie Going My Way. And it was a very popular song. Frank Sinatra did a version of it.
This was in the 40s, right?
Yes, right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, one of those priest movies.
Yes.
But in 1963, if I've got it right, little Eva, who introduced the locomotion.
That's right. That was her big hit.
Her big hit. Yeah. Maybe her biggest hit.
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Did a duet version with
Big D. Irwin.
Yeah.
So you had Big and Little.
Yeah, Big and Little. And of Swinging on a Star. And that's David's favorite version of the song, yes?
It is, yes.
Yes. So I thought we should hear it first. Here we go. This is the 1963 version of the 1940s Academy Award winner, Swinging on a Star.
His back is
Little Eva's version of Swingin' on a Star, which is the title of David Trinidad's most recent book from Turtle Point Press. The big poem in David Trinidad's Swinging on a Star is Ode to Buddy Holly. And, you know, since so much of rock and roll depended upon mortality and death, this celebrates the time that a poet needs to fully develop a voice. And that question, what if you never had the time to develop? What if you had died early, the way Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper all died on the same flight the day, as the song American Pie later has it, the day the music died? This is David Trinidad's Ode to Buddy Holly.
Ode to Buddy Holly. My first memory is of an airplane crash 2 years before yours, January 31st, 1957. 3 and a half, I sat watching black and white cartoons while my mother vacuumed in another room. There was a boom. The house shook. I remember being dragged out front and across a field toward the disaster. But how much did I actually see? It would be years before I learned what happened. 2 planes collided in the blue Southern California sky above Pacoima Junior High School, where over 200 boys were ending their athletic activities on the playground. Flaming debris rained down on them, killing 3 and injuring many others, some critically. Ritchie Valens was a student at the school, but wasn't there that day because he was attending his grandfather's funeral. We moved away several years later. You were newly dead when the Golden State Freeway was built, the lot where our house stood, now an off-ramp. I wouldn't learn your name until 1971, fresh out of Chatsworth High and newly 18 and just beginning to write. I heard Don McLean's American Pie on the radio. The disc jockey explained that the day the music died referred to the shock a dozen years earlier of your sudden death. From that moment on, you became a heroic figure, random victim, despite your fame, of indifferent fate, the burgeoning artist cruelly denied fulfillment of his gift. 44 years passed, 56 since your tragic crash, and I was asked to give a poetry reading at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, where you were born and raised. Newly 62, I happily said yes, and became obsessed in the weeks before my trip with your story, which I'd always only vaguely known. On the internet, I scrolled through the details of your accelerated life, how when you proposed to your wife, Maria Elena, on your first date, and she suggested waiting, you said, "I don't have time." How you said that a lot, "I don't have time." How you hardly ever slept, a trait common to those who die young. How, newly wed, you and Maria Elena moved into the Brevoort at 11 Fifth Avenue, 2 blocks north of Washington Square. How many times in all my years in New York did I pass that address, unaware that you once lived there? In apartment 4H, a matter of days before the winter dance party, you recorded your last songs. Just you, your acoustic guitar, and a tape recorder. Peggy Sue Got Married was one of them. Posthumously released, studio overdubs, background vocals, and additional instrumentation all but drowned out your guitar. The recorder also captured 3 minutes and 28 seconds of you and Maria Elena talking and laughing. Also sounds like plates being put away in the kitchen. The relentless pace of the tour and poor traveling conditions, the bus kept breaking down in below-zero blizzards as it zigzagged across the Midwest, wearied you. Due to the bus's faulty heater, your drummer was hospitalized with frostbite and left behind. Thereafter, your co-headliner, Richie Valens, backed you up on drums. By the time you reached Clear Lake, Iowa, a week and a half into the tour, you'd had enough. You chartered a private plane to take you to the next venue late that night, right after your show. A 16-year-old girl from Minnesota, with a crush on Richie, took the last known photo of you. On stage at the Surf Ballroom, pleated curtains behind you, teenage admirers below, you strum your 1958 Fender Stratocaster and sing into the silver mic, the lenses of your black-rimmed glasses, not yet iconic, glinting in the camera's flash. On my Mac, I looked at black-and-white pictures of the charred fuselage of the small plane, tangled in barbed wire. Scattered on the frozen field, three dark figures, three young rock-and-roll stars, each hunched face down as if trying to stay warm. Fine snow had fallen after the crash and drifted lightly about the bodies in wreckage. I downloaded and listened to your hits, That'll Be the Day, Oh Boy, Maybe Baby, Think It Over, Peggy Sue. Rave On, with its hiccupy hook and manic beat, a favorite, 59 plays on iTunes. I flew to Dallas from Chicago, changed to a smaller plane. Impossible not to think of you on the brief flight to Lubbock. I felt immediately at home in that flat, open landscape from which you sprang singing your songs. The tiny, antiquated airport, a portal into the past. On the way to the hotel, cotton fields, forever haunted, those stalks with their unpicked tufts of cloud-like white blooms. My reading wasn't until the following afternoon. I had the morning free. I'd planned in advance what I would do. On a clear, arid October day, I drove to your grave. I had to be there. Easy to find, a sign just inside the cemetery pointed to the site. First row along the road, surrounded by dry grass. A flat headstone engraved with your name and dates, with musical notes and leaves, holly leaves, I realized later, and an electric guitar leaning against a Grecian column. Above, stuffed in the sunken vase, dusty artificial flowers, gaudy star-shaped happy birthday balloon, weather-beaten Xeroxed photograph, you smiling in your thick black glasses. How many had stood there like me, hoping to sense your presence, or sat on the flattened grass and strummed your songs? Some had left guitar picks in the deep-set letters of your name, at least a dozen of them, plastic picks of all colors, red, yellow, green, blue, fading in the intense West Texas sun. Your parents, who stoically suffered your loss into old age, buried at your side. Scattered throughout the cemetery, gray and white feathers and an occasional carcass of white-winged doves killed in the night by foxes or coyotes or red-tailed hawks or feral cats, evidence of fresh death among the tombstones of the distantly departed. It was quiet and growing hot. A line of silver grain silos glinted in the near distance. I drove to the close-by Buddy Holly Center and looked at the glass cases full of your personal effects. Artifacts that, arranged chronologically, told the story of your mid-20th century American upbringing. Childhood drawings, cowboy galloping on stallion, horses grazing in a corral. The Crayolas you colored them with, burnt sienna, yellow-green. Your marbles and slingshot, hunting knives and rifles. Your white high-top Converse sneakers, on which you wrote your initials in blue ballpoint ink. White t-shirt, small, and denim jacket, both with Holly written inside the collar. Baseball glove, report cards, a pink autograph dog you signed All My Love on December 28, 1954. Your yearbooks, your camera, your collection of 45s with songs by the Everly Brothers and Ray Charles and Little Richard and Bo Diddley and, a surprise, Doris Day, on labels like Domino and Decca and Checker and Roulette. Then the vestiges of success. I stared at the framed gold record of Peggy Sue and at your black-rimmed glasses, lensless, in a glass case of their own. When your plane crashed, they landed in a snowbank and weren't discovered until the spring when the snow melted. They were brought to the local sheriff's office, sealed in a manila envelope, forgotten for over 20 years, and eventually found and returned to Maria Elena, who ensured they were put on permanent display. Also in a glass case of its own, standing upright, your Fender Stratocaster, which you last played less than an hour before your death, three-tone sunburst alder body and maple neck, the tip of a white Gibson guitar pick wedged under the edge of the plastic pick guard. You always stuck a spare pick there. The guitar traveled in the bus to your next engagement while you took to the air. In the large last case, your red and black aerial cyclone motorcycle, purchased on a lark in Dallas after returning from a tour. My eye went right to the round logo on the tank, Ariel. I thought of Sylvia Plath riding a horse named Ariel into a flaming sunrise. I thought of you riding a bike named Ariel on the empty stretch between Dallas and Lubbock. Two artists who made their mark and at the height of their creative powers, quickly disappeared. I thought about the years I've had, 40 more than you were permitted, and what it's taken for me to fulfill myself as a poet. No shooting star, though I've known and loved and lost a few, impetuously flashing toward blackness, I needed time. I who thought, when I was young, that it might be better to die young, now value and am thankful for the time I've been allowed. Time to study and learn, that never stops. Time to suffer and heal, that never stops either. Time to hoard and let go. Time to grow into and fully embody my words. Before leaving the Buddy Holly Center, I signed, with reverence, the guest book. In the space that asked what brought me to Lubbock, I wrote poetry. In the gift shop, I bought a guitar pick, white, like your spare. I drove back to the cemetery and placed it in the top of the E in Holly, the true spelling of your last name. I looked up at the sky, wide and untroubled, celestial blue, with only a few thin white streaks and sweeping mare's tails, strands of wispy cirrus clouds caused by ice crystals in the upper air. Later, after my reading, I was taken up to the 10th floor of the architecture building for a Lubbock sunset, well worth the 20-minute wait to see the sun, like a broken egg yolk, slowly seep into a flat, fiery horizon. The next day I flew home, upgraded to first class, with a check for $2,000 in my carry-on. $2,000 just for reading my poems. But more than money, buddy, poetry made it possible for me to place a white guitar pick on your grave. May you never again travel without a spare.
David Trinidad reading his ode to Buddy Holly from his book Swinging on a Star, published by Turtle Point Press. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with David Trinidad about his book, Swinging on a Star. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art, from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Trinidad about his book, Swinging on a Star, a two-part collection of poetry by a beloved poet who puts the human in pop culture. This is coming, Swinging on a Star, after one of David's big books, Dear Prudence, which was a new and selected poems.
Yes.
This is a small book, and anyone who loves but may be nervous about poetry can pick up this book, and the first half is made of very little poems, like haikus. They're like bonbons. You can eat them, and they're sweet and surprising. They're charming. Before I knew it, I was done with the first half of the book, which has poems. The first half is called Bedrock at Night, and it has poems about Fred and Barney Flintstone and those creatures who drove their cars for them, or were the horns on the...
The horn honker was a bird.
A Stone Age bird. It's a very enjoyable book. And then it gets serious with the poem that I wanted all of you to hear, because, you know, many of us who try to become artists, even me with my desire to be a real reader, not just a skimmer, it takes time to develop any art form. And David compares himself with Buddy Holly, who died so young, when David himself had a lifetime that he didn't expect to have to develop his form, his language as a poet. What makes you think it takes so much time?
Well, it did for me. You know, it didn't seem to take so much time for some of my contemporaries, you know, friends, poets that I sort of grew up with. But for me, it did take longer. I think in part because of sort of alcoholism and drug addiction in my 20s, and I got sober when I turned 30. And that's when I really began to write the way I wanted to write, had always wanted to write, in a more fluid sense.
Well, you had begun writing early on.
Yeah, like at 18 or...
Yeah. And there was a tragic moment that couldn't help but put a hiatus in that development. You were in...
A serious car accident with, when I was 25, with a good friend of mine, a very talented young poet that I'd met in college, named Rachel Sherwood. When you were introducing the poem, I was thinking, well, that's part of why that's in the ode for me, in the ode to Buddy Holly, because I had that near-death experience. I almost died young and then didn't. Although that's not explicitly in the poem, I feel like that informs it.
Well, it's very interesting because you published her book.
Yes, a book of her poems, yes.
Yes, and part of your career as a poet has been to publish the books of poets who died too soon. Tim Dugos is one of them. Now, more recently, Ed Smith, about whom you'll be hearing more on another Bookworm show. So that part of your nature is to preserve and revive the past, whether that's Bedrock of Flintstone fame or Buddy Holly, you or your friends,
yes,
who died before they had the chance to become the poets they might have been. you do a better, to my mind, you do a better job of that than anyone else I know. What do you suppose gave you the ability to put together these wonderful, essentially, scrapbooks of a lost poet's complete work?
Well, you know, I think in part it's what you said. I mean, you know, before I even published my first book of poems, I published a book of poems by a dead friend who had died tragically young. And then I co-edited the selected poems of Anne Stanford, who had been my teacher in college, and I loved her work. And it had fallen out of print, and I wanted it to come back into print. And then Tim Dugos, who was a good friend of mine, a young poet from New York, and he died at 40 of AIDS, leaving behind what turned out to be a massive body of work.
A vast number of very impressive poems that hadn't been published during his lifetime, in addition to the ones that were, some of which were published by Little Caesar Press, some of which you had yourself published in a book called A Fast Life.
And then Ed Smith, you know, whose work had also fallen out of print, and he died young as well. And so I think, in addition to that impulse of wanting to preserve their work and introduce readers to their poetry, I just love playing detective and piecing all the details together. And I guess I have an obsessive nature, so I find it fun, actually, a fun thing to do. I enjoy it.
I've been talking with David Trinidad, author of, as I'm sure you've heard, the terrific book of tiny and long poems, Swinging on a Star, published by Turtle Point Press. Thank you, David, for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Michael.
It's been great to have you. This has been a long-awaited opportunity. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all the podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt with my guest, David Trinidad. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Terrence Hayes is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.